It is time for Mike at the Movies.
Woo!
You chose Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Can you sum up why this was your choice for episode 100? Why The Wrath of Khan? Why not something else?
Well, we have a spreadsheet, and it lists movies that you haven't seen and some that I haven't seen.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a conversation, too, where we were talking about Star Trek, and you mentioned that you'd seen the new Star Trek movies, but not any of the old Star Trek movies. And that shocked and appalled me. And yeah. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan is one of my favorite movies of all time. So I thought you should watch it, because then you will have seen it. And if nothing else, I would also say that, like, do you watch the James Bond movies? Do you watch those?
Of course I do. I love the
You're James English. Bond. I think it's probably the law that you watch them.
It's in our school's curriculum.
Yes, exactly, as it should be. I would say Goldfinger, follow me here, Goldfinger is relevant not just because it's a good James Bond movie, and the third James Bond movie. But I think it's relevant in that I think you could probably look at every James Bond movie after Goldfinger as being an attempt to do Goldfinger in some way, to be Goldfinger. Goldfinger ended up becoming sort of the template for a James Bond movie.
I agree.
And I could argue, having seen all the Bond movies myself, I could argue to the detriment of the series as a whole, because sometimes I feel like the Bond movies needed to try and not be Goldfinger and just do something different, and instead they kept on kind of replaying aspects of Goldfinger, not always the same aspects, but replaying the aspects. I would make that same argument for Star Trek II. I feel like Star Trek II, which was coming on the heels of not very successful, very expensive, and not generally well-liked Star Trek the Motion Picture, although it did actually do well in the box office. It was not critically successful, and everybody thought it was pretty boring. They gave them a much smaller budget to make this movie, and people really liked it. It was a critical success. It did pretty well at the box office, and then they made many more Star Trek movies after this. That's all great, but I also feel like the weight of Star Trek II on every other Star Trek movie that I see it. All the J.J. Abrams produced Star Trek movies have it. Star Trek Into Darkness is essentially a 2-hour homage to Star Trek II. And but even the Next Generation movies feel like you can see the way the villains are constructed in Star Trek movies. It's just so much of Star Trek on film is an attempt to kind of recreate or quote Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. So on that level, I kind of feel like it's worth watching just from as a representative of the best of the original crew movies, and as the movie that sort of defined what people were going to try to do with Star Trek movies after that.
So thank you for your opening statement.
That is my opening statement. Turns out I wasn't expecting it, but there it was.
I have an opening statement.
Okay.
So my opening statement is my feelings that I wrote down before I watched the movie. This is Mike at the Movie style here.
Okay.
I was not excited about this movie, Jason. I had been dreading it. I don't know why. I just thought I wasn't going to like it. I don't know why.
There's a reason why I hadn't picked it up till now, too, is I've been a little worried about it, too.
And this is because I think this ends up in why I ended up just watching it this morning. We picked this weeks ago, but I watched it today. I put it off to the very last moment. But I do actually enjoy watching them on the same day because they're fresh in my mind. One of the reasons that I wasn't looking forward to this is that I have such little knowledge about Star Trek, and especially this crew. Like, I know these people to be the Star Trek crew, right? Like, we just know this about them. You know,
sure.
Shatner and Nimoy, like, they are synonymous with Star Trek, but I've never watched any of it, so I have no feeling about them, right?
It's
just not something that I have ever paid any attention to, so it's just been a thing that I had absolutely no attachment to, and I thought that was going to hinder my enjoyment of the movie, because my instinct was that you would only really enjoy it if you were coming to them with both existing emotional attachment and knowledge of the TV show and previous movie. That was my feeling. I was coming mm-hmm. into the sequel. So that I figured I would not enjoy this movie. I have a question for you.
Yes.
Were these the TV show actors? Like, this is the crew that were in the TV show, right?
Yes. And I would actually say it's not a sequel. It's funny because it's Star Trek II, because the motion picture was completely different in terms of production design than this movie, and the producers were different. The creative team was essentially different. Just the just the actors are the same.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it might be a sequel in name only, but two suggests sequel.
True.
To me,
well, I mean, and on Star Trek, right? I mean, it's at the very least, it's a sequel to 70 some odd episodes of a TV show that became successful, and then they made a movie, and now here's another movie, right? You're coming in, you're coming in 80 hours late, basically.
Yep. It's difficult for me to tell because of when the movie was made. So when was it? 82.
82. Yeah, so it's the core cast. The seven core cast members are from the original Star Trek. There are other actors in this that were not seen in the original Star Trek. Ricardo Montalban was in an episode of the original Star Trek that this is the sequel to. If it is a sequel to anything, it is to an episode called Space Seed, where they find Khan floating in space and they bring him on board the Enterprise, and he tries to take the Enterprise over, and they beat him and put him on a planet and say, instead of arresting him and taking him into prison, they put them all down on a planet that is rough, but they should be able to make a living there. And they say, well, it'll be interesting to check back in 100 years and see what the supermen can do with this planet. And that was so Montalban was in that. All the other actors in this have not been in Star Trek before. Kirstie Alley wasn't in Star Trek before. Merritt Buttrick and B.B. Besh, who play Carol and David Marcus, were not in Star Trek before. Just Montalban and then the core sort of seven cast members.
So I think I'm going to have a really weird opinion of this movie, which...
You watched Star Trek Into Darkness before you watched Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, so you've already got a very weird perspective on this movie.
The thing is, though, like, yeah, but they don't feel like anything close to each other other than the names were used to me. Like, it just doesn't feel like at all the same movie. Like, the plot is so different.
I agree. It's really the stuff at the end that is quoted directly by the other movie. Yeah.
Like that one scene, like the scene where everybody, well, not everybody, the scene where there's like the death, right? But they reverse the roles.
Right. Exactly.
And also, it's not the same anyway, right? Because Kirk lives.
I know. There is that one little thing that, well, I'm spoiler for movies from the 80s, they bring Spock back too.
I guessed that the end of the movie couldn't write that more if it tried.
I know.
I was honestly expecting for like Spock's hand to come out of the casket at the end. Like this planet generates life. It generates life, you say? Like, oh, come on.
I know. It's true. Yes, well, Star Trek 3 is called The Search for Spock. And guess what? They find Spock. But anyway, this is not about Star Trek 3.
So what I was going to ask you, and what I was saying, like the reason this is difficult for me because of the time it was made, was this movie, did it have a big movie budget, or is it like an extended episode of a TV show budget-wise? Like,
well, it's more, I mean, the TV show, if you see any of those old TV episodes, the budget was a lot lower for those. But it is not, so Star Trek The Motion Picture was made on an enormous budget. And like I said, it's really boring. This was made on a much, much smaller budget. So it is, I wouldn't say a low budget movie, but I would say it is a modest budget for a science fiction feature film in 1982.
Okay, cool. All right. So I feel like I'm going to hold off my feelings about this movie because they change so much throughout my notes. I don't want to spoil it because I'll have to give... It won't make sense, I don't think.
Okay.
So...
Where do you want to start?
Start at the start. I'm going to go chronologically through my thoughts here. Kobayashi Maru. I know what this is!
Yeah, well, this is one of those things that's been quoted. The J.J. Abrams movie, the first J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie, we see Captain Kirk cheat at the Kobayashi Maru, and this is where that originated, in this movie, where we see... And it's funny, one of the funny things about this, the way this movie starts, is it's the bridge of the Enterprise, and everybody we see is familiar, except instead of Kirk as the captain, there is this Vulcan woman... played by Kirstie Alley, sitting in the captain's chair. And it's meant to be like, what?
It's a double like, fake out, right?
It
like
is,
it's
right.
There's a new crew and then they all die.
They all die.
But it's a simulation. And so like one of the moments is ruined for me in this movie because I know that Kirk cheats.
Yeah.
to be it. That's because true. I've learned that from the other movie, because that was a important plot point later. So like, yes. And then they kind of had the fake out, and everybody is established, and we find out that Kirk is now an admiral.
Right.
And it's his birthday. And there is a lot being set up here, which I think is a good way to play it because of how everybody looks, that everyone's getting old. That is a big theme about this movie.
Yeah.
These actors, I mean, I don't know how old they are, but they look TV old to me.
So the I think the implication, and it's never said outright, is that Captain Kirk is turning 50.
Okay.
And that's what's happening here. Another funny note is that Star Trek, the motion picture, I would argue, tries to make them seem like... It feels much more like a continuation of the original series. Like, well, yeah, it's 10 years later, but we're still off for some dashing adventures with your young TV crew. They're a little older, but still we're off. And here, which is only 3 years later, in this movie, they're like, no, they're getting old. Like, that is what this movie is about. It's about getting old and coming to terms with your mortality and all of these things. And so I think to this movie's great benefit, that's what they decided to do with this movie, as yep. opposed to the movie 3 years before. And if you see pictures from it, they're all wearing, like, uniforms that look like they're in pajamas. And they're like, fighting against age, and here they're embracing it, or at least being aware of it, from the very first scene where Kirk says gallivanting around the cosmos is a game for the young, and he walks out. And they're like, what's his problem?
Yeah, so it's like, it's his birthday, they have all these new crew and these new recruits that Spock is leading, because Kirk is an admiral now, and Spock is now a captain. One of the ways that I really like that they set up the age thing with Kirk is having him have reading glasses. And they come up with, like, an in-universe reason that he has to have reading glasses, which he's, like, allergic to some drug that people take now, which is genius. It
fixes your vision, yeah. And he's like, no, yeah, I know. So the doctor, Dr. McCoy, comes over and says, normally I'd give you this drug, but instead have these old glasses. And also he brings illegal whiskey, or Romulan ale.
Romulan ale. I don't know why they call it ale, but then drink it like it's whiskey. Why didn't they just call it Romulan whiskey?
That's how the Romulans do it. No. I don't know.
No, unacceptable. Unacceptable.
At the Star Trek experience in Las Vegas, when that was open, you could order a Romulan ale. It was blue.
Was it a short drink?
No, it was an ale. It was actual beer.
What's going on here? It's ridiculous.
And it was blue. Yeah, I know.
And then I'm going to kind of jump around in this a little bit, because I tend to write more like exhaustive notes, but I didn't with this one, just because sometimes these can run forever. I'm going to jump to next is when Chekhov and his captain, I believe his name was Terrell.
Yes.
They investigate a planet to be used for an experiment. And all we kind of know at the moment is it's an experiment. And they come across someone's living quarters, and Chekhov freaks out when he sees Botany Bay.
Oh, no.
Perfect. And then he whispers, Khan, like that. And then it's established Khan appears, and him and his crew capture Chekhov and Terrell. And Chekhov refers to Khan as a product of late 20th century genetic engineering.
Right.
Which is good, because it then proved to me why he was so strong. Now, this is where the story goes a bit weird for me, as someone who has no prior experience. It's really interesting to me to know that people that watched the franchise would know all about Khan.
Well, but the way the movie is structured, right, is they don't want just people who have an encyclopedic knowledge of Star Trek. So if you know that episode, you're like, oh, yes. But if you don't, they need to explain it for you, because I think they have to assume that most of the people going to the movie in 1982 are not going to remember that episode of Star Trek from 1968.
Sure, but the reason I mention this is because they do explain it, but they explain it in such a way that the story makes Kirk sound like a villain to me.
Yeah. From Khan's perspective, he is, for sure.
But even the way that Chekhov explains it is like, we marooned this guy here, like, we sent him here, and him and his crew were basically just sent either to die or to make their own way. And Chekhov says that Khan tried to kill Kirk, which was made me realize that there was some kind of evil doings here. But the whole and this actually is something that prevails throughout the whole movie to me, is like, who is good and bad? I've really struggled to work it out.
Well, one of the good, a good villain has a motivation. And I think that's one of the strengths of Khan is that we, even though, yes, he's a madman out for vengeance, he has his reasons because, as Chekhov says, on SETI Alpha 5, there was life and a chance that they put him on a good planet where they could make a living and not be miserable. And in this, this is an inhospitable desert that they're in. And then Khan replies with the classic line, "This is SETI Alpha 5, which is, oh, crap. You know, this is not the planet I thought it was. Chekhov is a little confused here because Chekhov is expecting to see a fairly lush, you know, world where they're able to establish themselves instead of this complete, like, ruined desert. But yep. something happened and a planet exploded or whatever, and it ruined the ecology of this planet. So Kirk has unwittingly sent them to basically almost like a death sentence on this. A terrible subsistence living is all that they can manage in this on this desert planet. So Kirk's little plan to get to let them not be put in prison has backfired and made Khan furious, and his wife died, and he's very angry.
He then, Khan plants these bugs.
Yep, the SETI eels.
Into very realistic-looking ears of Terrell and Chekhov.
That's what people remember from this movie a lot, is the bugs in the ears.
And, because it's horrifying. And these bugs wrap around the cerebral cortex and make people very suggestible until they go mad.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure he said mad and die, even though...
Yeah.
Chekhov doesn't die.
Well, that's because it comes out. Like, it's not explained why that happens.
Yeah, don't, it's like for fun.
To close attention, but it pops out of his ear and it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I saw that it came out, but it's like, why did it come out? Like, do you, that is just not explained. Just like, oh, Chekhov lived.
He was very angry or upset and it ran away, I guess. Yeah, it's not explained at all.
And then we go back to Kirk. Kirk is taking... He's at the Enterprise. He's gone for an inspection with some of the old crew, including is it Bones? He goes with Bones, Sulu, and Uhura. Right? They go to make an inspection on the Enterprise, and very quickly Kirk takes control of the Enterprise to investigate a research facility. After he's received, does he receive a message? Yeah, he receives a message that they can't fully understand.
Yeah, there's a garbled message he gets from Carol Marcus, who he knows. We are led to believe that they have a past because McCoy brings it up. We see her with her son earlier, where they get the call from Chekhov,
but we don't know it's her son yet.
Yeah, that's true. It's just a tall blonde fellow.
Yeah.
But they does he not call her mother at that point?
No, he doesn't.
Anyway, you know, they're skeptical because of, you know, he doesn't trust the Federation. He doesn't trust the Captain Kirk. All of these things are going on with these poor scientists who are being, the Chekhov ship is trying to work for them. And now they're worried that the military is going to take their experiment away from them. And so Kirk gets the garbled message from her. And that they're taking Genesis. Why are you taking Genesis? And it breaks up, jammed at the source, which yep. is a bad sign. And so then Kirk and Spock and McCoy are like, Genesis, anyone? And he has to explain that it's a weapon. It's supposed to be a scientific tool, but it could be used as a weapon if you fire it at a planet.
A devastating weapon.
It will turn it into a new planet with life on it. But if there's life on the planet, it will just destroy the planet and replace it with new life instead.
So then we get Kirk taking control of the Enterprise again after a great exchange between him and Spock, where Spock's like, I know you want to do this, like, just do this. Like, let's just stop. He's like, I have no ego to be bruised here. I'm a yeah. Vulcan. Like, just take control of the ship. So he does, and you can see how excited he is. Like, he's super happy to take control again. The Genesis device is a really great MacGuffin.
Yeah, it's their nuclear bomb, basically.
Yeah, it's very well made, and it's also, you can see why it exists. Like, so many of these things that become weapons, like, why does it exist in the first place? Like, why would anybody build this? It's obvious how terrible this is going to go. But with this one, it's like, yeah, it could go bad, but the good is so good, it's worth doing.
Well, it's made by idealistic scientists who, I mean, it's this constant push and pull between the scientists who build things and the military that deploy them. And the argument here is that they're building this because the galaxy is filled with lifeless planets, and we can use this technology to instantly make them livable, to terraform them. And that is fantastic, because then there are more places to grow things and for people to live. The demo reel, by the way, is one of the first substantial pieces of computer animation in any motion picture. That's an entirely computer animated demo where they shoot the missile onto the dead world and then like zip through on the surface and come back around on the other side, and it's a living world. That's basically the first big piece of CGI in any movie.
I bet that cost a lot of money.
I think it did.
Yeah. Is Khan's chest real?
You know, I want to believe.
I don't think it is. It looked very fake to me. And it was just, I kept looking at it. It's like, you got a real chest there, Ricardo. I couldn't tell. I don't think it was. It looked too perfectly sculpted.
It's very impressive, though, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's the fact that it's on show as much as it is makes me think it's not real. I don't know. But if it was real, bravo, Ricardo. Bravo. You did good work there, my friend. Did good work indeed. I found it really interesting how, so they have their first encounter, right, where it's ship versus ship, because Khan's taken control and he's brought the, what was the name of the ship?
The Reliant.
And they've kind of tricked the Enterprise into believing,
right, we're
that
all one happy
wrong.
Fleet.
Yeah,
you know, where they don't have their shields up. It's a really nice exchange where they get, as Kirk says, he gets caught with his britches down, Kirk has to reason a way out of this, a trick to survive, because Khan is just going to blow them up.
So then there's like he ends up overriding the control panel because it's a failsafe built in for this very reason. Also, yep, very believable. This movie is very well written for the way they get out of things. They're all plausible, and that is very plausible. It's like, well, of course you have an override, right? And of course nobody knows it, right? Like it's got to be kept secret. It's the point of the override.
And Scott McNulty always points out that you probably shouldn't have the password to control your starship be 6 digits, but it was 1982. It's fine.
They didn't have the computing power, I guess, maybe in the future, the history past. And so then they fight back and that kind of thing, and they end up scaring them away, effectively. It gets really dark here in a way that I didn't expect. The injuries are very graphic of the crew of the Enterprise, and the one guy that dies.
Yeah, the one crewman, the young engineering crewman, has horrible burns and dies.
And leaves the literal blood of himself on Kirk.
On Kirk's jacket for as long as he wears that jacket.
It's very ham-fisted, right? Like the blood of these people is on Kirk, but it's still makes the point that for the next while you were very aware of the mistake that Kirk made, even though I feel a bad point in this movie, a point that could be done differently, is he shows no remorse for this, Kirk. Like, they have that one moment in the medical bay, but at no other point in this movie is it even referenced that a bad call from him or not reacting well enough resulted in all these young people dying on their first mission, which they were never supposed to go on in the first place, which he urged to go on because he was so desperate to go on another mission. Like, this is never really called up by anyone, including him. And especially when at the end of the movie, like, this line's like, you've never faced death like this before, have you, Dad? Like, what about all the people that died?
Yeah. No, I think it's a good point. And also, there's a moment where, you know, he's really responsible. His judgment, I think it's all weighing on him throughout. But I agree, it's not as directly addressed as maybe it could be. There's a funny, quirky, you know, it's not a funny moment, but there's a moment where Terrell says to him later, he blames you for the death of his wife. And Kirk says, I know what he blames me for. but you know, it is a reminder that, you know, Kirk got them into this. Not only did he take the ship and then keep the shields down and allow all that damage to happen that he has to then kind of work his way out of, but he caused this problem. Like, it's his problem. And it's come back to haunt him.
Yeah, he made a previously bad decision to exile these people.
And everyone around him, yes.
The kind of the brutalness of it all continues as Kirk beams to the research facility.
The space station, yeah.
And they are brutally murdered, all of the scientists, and like hung.
It's
very brutal. Like this movie is not as happy-go-lucky as I was expecting an 80s Star Trek movie to be, in all honesty.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know if that is something I should or shouldn't have expected.
Star Trek IV is the happy-go-lucky movie you want, but this is not it. Yeah,
I don't know if it's what I want. I actually think I prefer this because I think part of what I was dreading was it was just going to be like bubblegum space movie.
Oh yeah. Oh no, it's I like this. In fact, the so in the 80s, I had the novelization of Star Trek II. And one of the things that I really like that's not in the movie, that's in the book, is you spend way more time with these scientists and you see when Khan comes and they're trying to get away as the Khan and his people are killing them. And it's horrific. And here all we get is the aftermath, which is they beam down to the station. Where is everybody? And there's a whole bunch of dead scientists hung upside down with their throats cut in the middle of this thing. And you just get the sense like something, you know, this is a murder scene. And the movie, you know, you get it, but you don't see all that horrible violence. But obviously this is a place of horrible violence. Somebody, Khan came here and killed the scientists who were working on Genesis. And he didn't get what he wants, apparently, because he's still asking for it. So what's
that about?
It's also
not completely clear. I wasn't expecting this. Like, a couple of reasons. And I think the movie sets it up well. Like, Chekhov says it will be 3 days until they get there. Now, obviously, he was tricking them.
He was lying, yeah. Yeah.
So that, but I didn't realize that. It didn't even cross my mind. And also, when Khan comes to attack the Enterprise, there is no reference made to the fact that their mission was so far unsuccessful.
Right.
So it was a surprise to see everybody dead. I was expecting them to get there and all the scientists were going to be there, you know, and then they were going to work on a plan together.
Yeah, they leave that moment for the characters from the Enterprise to discover that there's nobody there, and that's the an interesting. I mean, not only is it horrible, and you're like, oh, Khan was already here. He killed everybody. Then he came and asked us about this. What's that about? Did he not get what he wants? What's going on? And then it gives them a little mystery to solve on the space station of what's going on here.
And then they meet Terrell and Chekhov. They're like hidden away in there. And it's interesting at this point because I genuinely couldn't tell who they were working for.
Uh-huh.
Which is, again, very well written. Mm-hmm. Because it's like, all I know is they're suggestible, right? Like that they can be kind of swayed. So like my thinking is, are they being swayed by Khan still, or is now like, are they looking at Kirk and doing whatever he wants him to do? Like, it's really hard to at this point to place, like, who are they working for? Like, were they just left there, which they could have conceivably just been left there because they were useless now?
Chekhov says we beat them. The captain was strong, and the implication is that they just left him behind. Khan left him behind because they weren't of any use to them anymore.
But then when they then beam down to the site where all the Genesis stuff is being held underground on a planet somewhere, Terrell and Chekhov turn on them, but then Terrell kills himself.
Right, constant fire, you know, kill him, and he turns the phaser on himself and then pulls the trigger.
And then Chekhov's bug jumps out of his ear for fun.
Yeah. Ah, he screams and is dead. Because he's a regular character and we don't want him to die. So he just lays down.
And Khan knew where they were because Terrell or Chekhov were wearing this bracelet.
Yeah.
It wasn't completely clear what happened previously, like how Khan knew. Like, I didn't get that. I was like, how does he know? Like, he went to a scene and it was like he was in the next room or something. It was very confusing. But then later I worked it out.
Yeah, because Terrell says, Your Excellency, have you been listening?
Yeah.
Yes, I have been listening.
So I think they could have done this part without the scene where they show Khan listening, because that actually made it more confusing for me because I couldn't work out how he was hearing them. And then we find, you know, it's obvious then that there's like some kind of bracelet, which Kirk then screams "Khan" twice into, right?
Yeah, so they're doing their like back and forth with each other, which one of the things, I don't know if you realize this, if you noticed this, but you know, Kirk and Khan are never in the same physical space. The actors were never together in this movie.
I did not realize that until you just said it.
they're on screen with each other and they're over the bracelet, but they're never in the same room together. At any point, Montalban and Shatner are never in the
same
room
together. How interesting. Because I felt like they were all the time.
I know, right? And the back and forth here is really great too, because this is they're both trying to out-bluster one another. But Khan takes Khan takes the Genesis device. So Khan wins this round, because basically Kirk just did Khan's job for him. Khan couldn't figure it out, but Kirk figured out where it was, led them right to it, and now they've stolen the ultimate weapon. And what's worse, they've stranded Kirk and his people in the middle of this asteroid, in this cave in the middle of this asteroid. So Khan says, I could kill you, but I'm not going to bother. I'm going to abandon you like you abandoned me. And he takes off.
We then find out that Kirk has a son.
Yes, the blonde guy is David Marcus, and then that's the back history with Carol is that they had a son and he stayed away, and David doesn't even know that he's his son.
And they had used this planet to use Genesis Underground, and then they have this incredible looking facility where we believe that they're going to be stranded to for a while, right? They go out and they eat in this place, and it is then that Kirk realizes he lets us know that he was bluffing about a previous communication between him and Spock, where Spock told him it would take 2 days before they could be repowered. But Kirk and Spock, because they know each other so well, they knew that right. There was bluffing going on in case they were being listened to, which they were. And 2 days actually just meant 2 hours, and they tricked Khan. So Khan thinks that they're stranded.
This is right after he reveals to Savik about what he did in the Kobayashi Maru test at the beginning of the movie. This came up. It's like, you know, it's like there's no way to win. And he gives the usual line of, well, you got to deal with death. And then here they're eating like apples sitting in the on a cliff of this cave. And she says, I would like to know what you did. And I think it's Dr. McCoy is like, you're looking at the only kid who beat the no win scenario. And he says, yeah, I reprogrammed the test. You cheated. I changed the conditions of the test so that I could win. I got a commendation for original thinking. And she's kind of aghast. And that you see that play out in the J.J. Abrams 2009 Star Trek. You get to see him reprogram the simulator and all of that, much to Spock's consternation in that movie. But with Bones's help, which is kind of a funny little bit and he's eating an apple in Star Trek 2009 when that all goes on, which is a callback to them sitting here eating apples in the cave. And then immediately, like out of nowhere, after he said, see how clever I am, I reprogrammed the test. And they're like, oh, well, I don't know if I can trust you. He just pops out the communicator and is like, Kirk to Spock, you ready? And as an audience member, I was like, what?
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't work out what had happened.
This is Captain Kirk's magic trick. He's like, he's way ahead of you. He's figured it all out, and you're just waiting for him to figure it out. It's I love that scene because he explains, like, I don't ever accept that it's a no-win situation, and I'm not going to do it now either. And let me demonstrate. Spock's waiting for me. Let's get back up to the ship. I love that scene.
So they then kind of trick Khan a little bit. So they're going into this nebula. And this nebula would mean that none of the systems could be used, right? None of the tracking systems or the shields.
Yeah, the idea is that the Enterprise is really crippled more than the Reliant is. But if they go into the nebula, the odds will be even because nobody can use their shields and nobody can see particularly well. And so it'll be a fairer battle because they can't beat them in clear combat. But they could beat them in this hazy sort of submarine warfare kind of thing. And Khan's second in command, played by Judson Scott, Joachim, knows this, right? And he's like, I'm slowing down. And that's a kind of a fun scene where Spock is like, well, they're slowing down. And Kirk says, put me on with Khan. And he gives him a little, he just goads him. It's like, Khan, right. Like, look, I'm still alive. Ha ha.
So here's another thing. He wants to set him up to murder him.
Well, but they're trying to beat him. I mean, this is the idea is I got to get you to chase me in here because that's the only way we're going to be able to escape.
But here's the thing about it is it's not just Khan though, is it?
Sure.
On that ship.
Well, no, they say that they left the whole crew behind on SETI Alpha 5, so it's just Khan and his people. Khan and his other genetically engineered people, the 72 super people from 1996. Back in the old days of 1996, when we left on spaceships. So anyway, they floor it at that point. Khan's like, no, chase him. We gotta go get him, because Khan is obsessed with Kirk. He has to kill Kirk. And Kirk knows this and uses it against him. No! Oh!
Khan's downfall is his lust for revenge.
Yeah, no, this is the... I mean, that's the Moby Dick reference that gets made a couple of times, too, because that's a book about a sailor who is obsessed, and his obsession is his downfall, and... That's what they're going for here, is Khan is out for the wrath of Khan. It was originally called the vengeance of Khan, and he's out for revenge, and the revenge is his downfall. At one point, Joachim says to him, we can go anywhere we want. We've got a spaceship. And Khan's like, no, I must kill Kirk.
And also, they have the most powerful weapon available.
Yeah, they can go anywhere and do anything, and he is not willing to do that, because he's out for vengeance.
And so they enter the nebula, they have a fight, and the Enterprise ends up taking out most of Khan's crew, which is, again, one of these other morally strange parts to me. But, like, I don't know, there's just, like, the amount of people that we were watching being destroyed. Yeah. Just, like, killed them all, man. Like,
yeah,
okay.
Well, they're Khan's people. I think the idea is that they're, you know, you're in a space battle with another ship. That's part of the deal. And in the end, it's not Khan who, I mean, it's not... Kirk kills some of the people on the ship, but they're like they ask him to surrender, and Khan's like, no, I'm blowing everything up now. Right? I mean, he doesn't care either about whatever's left of his crew. He's going to blow up his ship and take Kirk with him.
I mean, he doesn't care about Kirk's crew either, but Kirk's meant to be the good guy.
Yeah. No, they're the enemy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I couldn't tell here if the nebula scenes were tense or unnecessarily slow paced. There was lots of back and forth of like faces, and I didn't really feel the tension. It just felt like it was taking too long.
I think, like, that may be a difference between 1982 and 2016.
That's a good point. Yeah,
I think maybe that it would be faster paced now. The idea there is they're trying to build tension. They want it to be like a submarine battle. Something like Hunt for Red October, the idea that they're moving very slowly. The way that they beat Khan in the battle is that Khan is thinking in terms of going left and right, and they go up and down. He's thinking two-dimensionally, which you would do in space if you were somebody who's used to being like from a planet, and the spacemen of the 23rd century are capable of flying their spaceship up and down too.
Yep.
And that they use that to beat him. I think that the pacing is not what you would do today,
because then also Khan very slowly with his last ounce of strength activates the Genesis weapon.
Well, he has a speech to give, Mike.
Most of it he's not even talking, he's just turning a dial and then pressing a button.
No.
And turning a dial and that part takes way too long. And then Spock sacrifices himself, right? Like, because basically they need the ship's power core or whatever to be repaired, but nobody can go and repair it because it's horrifically radioactive.
Right.
And if this is done, then they can go into, what do they call it?
Warp speed? Warp speed and escape. The only way they can escape, they're going full impulse. Sulu's got full impulse, but they're not going to make it. In fact, I think Sulu says in one of the lines that I like, we're not going to make it, are we? And Spock has that moment where he's sitting in the chair and he's like, okay, I gotta do this, because they got to get the warp drive back online or everybody's going to die. And so he goes into the radioactive chamber. Scotty tries to stop him. Bones tries to stop him. He gives Bones the neck pinch and then puts his fingers on his head and says, remember. I wonder what that's setting up. And that's setting up the next movie. And he goes in, he sacrifices himself to save the ship. He bathes in the radiation, gets the warp drive back online. They zip away. Yay! Thereby saving everybody. And the Genesis torpedo blows up and kills Khan and his crew and the spaceships and all of that. But not the Enterprise.
Not before Khan says, for hate's sake, I spit my last breath at thee. Bit melodramatic.
I think that's Moby Dick again.
Oh, really? That's too much.
Yeah.
If that's the quote, that's too much. That's too on the nose.
There's a lot of Moby Dick in this. In Star Trek VI, there's a lot of Shakespeare. I think that's a yes. Yeah.
Spock is in bad shape, and he repeats something that he says earlier about the needs of the many, and Kirk ends it by saying outweighs the needs of the few, or the one, or whatever it was that they mentioned, as they kind of change it a little bit. Then they do the Vulcan salute thing through the glass, live long and prosper, Spock dies. Yep. I didn't expect him to remain dead, as I mentioned. Like, I was expecting hand out of casket or something.
Dun, dun, dun.
But then there's the father and son moment that we referenced with the, you've never seen death. And then it's like, I love you, Dad. I love you, son. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then there's the whole point at the end where it's like, I feel young and life and blah, 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 blah.
I think tonally questionable moment. I feel like this movie is, the whole idea is that Kirk's taking a journey and he needs to embrace, accept his mortality and embrace that he needs to do what he can with his life. Because it's going to end and he's going to get old and die and he just needs to do it. It does seem awfully sunny after all these people have died and, including all the scientists and all of the people on Khan's ship and a bunch of people on the Enterprise, and Spock has died. And then in the end, Kirk's there with the mother of his son wearing his jacket next to him, and he's like, yeah, I'm feeling pretty good right now. It's like, I don't know about that. That's a little weird. That's a weird moment.
So I thought this movie was going to be slow and kind of dumb and was only going to be interesting to people that liked Star Trek.
What is Jason making me watch?
Right? This was how I felt. I was like, this is going to be a disaster for me. But I felt like it moved super fast.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was over in a flash. I was very surprised about that. And it had a lot more thought and moral questioning in it than I expected. And they didn't lean too heavily on the previous knowledge of the viewer.
Right.
And I got to say, I enjoyed it. I did. I enjoyed it. This is not going to make my top five of the movies.
Nor should it. No.
But I enjoyed it vastly more than I thought I was going to. I thought this was going to be one of the rare, I think maybe the only Mike at the Movies suggestion that I didn't like. I don't think there's been one that I didn't like before. From you, anyway. I've disliked movies that Casey has shown
Casey,
me.
Sorry, Casey.
But of the upgrade Mike at the Movies, I have never disliked a movie, and you have kept that crown going because I did. I enjoyed it. I think maybe of all of the movies that I've seen, I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. The most like the rest of them, there have been elements that I thought would work or I would like. And then some of them surprised me more than expected. Like, Say Anything continues to be a massive surprise to me. It will probably always be the most surprising, just how much I adored that movie. And some of them disappointed me a little bit. Like, Real Genius disappointed me a little bit in areas because there's a lot of questionable humor in that, which I didn't like.
Indeed.
But this movie only surprised me positively, even if I thought some things were uncomfortable. Like, I still dislike the kind of feeling of Kirk's bad actions and that there's no consequences for him.
Right.
Literally none.
Well, I guess, the consequences are that Spock dies. I guess that ultimately
Spock
that's
Spock comes
the
back to life again.
Like, it's true. Yeah,
so
it's true.
There are no consequences for Kirk's actions, even when they are bad and or questionable.
Yeah.
And that I don't like. And I don't know why I felt this so strongly in this movie when there are so many movies like it. But I think it was purely because of the way that Khan is introduced as someone who is done wrong before you find out what he did.
Yeah, he has a legitimate grievance against Kirk. I think he does.
A great suggestion and a movie worthy to take the episode 100 crown. So thank you, Jason.
I'm glad you liked it. I think it's a good movie, and there are good and bad Star Trek movies, but Star Trek 2 is a good movie It has some of the best space battle scenes, I think, in any movie, even though the effects are obviously dated. I think they're actually pretty darn good for 1982.
The effects held up surprisingly well. I thought that this was some kind of special edition or something that I was watching.
No, the phaser blasts on the hull, they get the big scorch marks and people are screaming and jumping around and all of that. And it all is kind of logical. And how do you resolve it? Unexpected places they go down deeper, they go to the space station, nobody's there except dead bodies, and they go deeper into the planet, and then you get the back and forth between Shatner and Montalban, which is so great. And it is amazing that they never actually share space. It's just on one end of a communicator or other, but their back and forth is great, and fittingly kind of they're both trying to outdo each other and go even further over the top with their back and forth, and it's great. I like it a lot, and I like the end. The end is very sad. When I saw this in the movie theater as a kid, I just sobbed when Spock died. It was so sad. I think looking back on it now, of course, then they just bring him back and he's in all the other movies. And that devalues the end of this a little bit. It would have been more sad, obviously, if he had actually stayed dead, but that didn't happen. And they were already, as you pointed out, quite rightly, laying the groundwork for him to come back. Because the way the story goes is Leonard Nimoy said, "I'd be in Star Trek 2 if you killed me." And they're like, "All right, we'll do that." And then by the end of the shoot, he's like, "Hey," because the Star Trek motion picture wasn't very good. And I think people didn't really have a good time on it. By the end of the movie, he's like, "Hey, this is pretty good. I'd do more." And they're like, okay. So they left themselves some outs so they could bring him back. And then they did.
Which is why that whole line, all those lines are there at the end.
Yeah, and they remember putting the hand on Dr. McCoy. That's in there. And then they show the casket lovingly panning over the casket. No hand emerges, but that is the implication, right?
It didn't make sense to me why the caskets remain intact on these planets.
Exactly.
Like, why are they made to do that? Like, there'd just be dead bodies just strewn all over these planets.
I know. I think they figured, I think they usually like fire them into the sun or something, but in this case, they fired it into the Genesis planet. But of course, the Genesis planet is like nothing we've seen before, so. But that's another movie.
The way I retconned this was that, because maybe I didn't pay enough attention, was that they put him in an escape pod, not a coffin.
Oh, it's a torpedo. It's a photon torpedo.
Right, but then it makes no freaking sense why it stayed in peace, because surely a torpedo should explode.
Well, they took the explosives out and put a Vulcan in it instead.
Yeah, but still.
I don't know.
How strong should the structures be?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, it makes no sense to me why that stayed intact. It should have broken into pieces when it hit the Earth.
It's magic.
Or whatever it is.
It's the same. Mike, it's the same reason that Chekhov doesn't die.
Yeah,
it would be inconvenient. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you like it. I'm glad you like it. I like it too, and I'm glad you do. It's a fun movie with some great performances and a good script. And in fact, that's one of the things that I think is not a bad influence but a good influence on future Star Trek is the writer and director of this has been involved with other Star Treks. He actually wrote Star Trek and directed Star Trek VI, Nicholas Meyer, and was involved in the Star Trek movies for quite a while. And my understanding is he is actually one of the consulting producers and writers on the new Star Trek series that's coming out in January. So they're kind of honoring him.
The TV show.
Yeah.
Cool.
For his work. But he injected... Look, Star Trek as a movie franchise would not exist if this had been a bad movie. The only reason that there were more Star Trek movies is that Star Trek 2 was really good, because it was on a $16 million budget or whatever it was, small budget, and it was not really given a lot of support, and it was a good movie, and that's the only reason Star Trek continued after that. Only reason.